Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
You know, I always wanted to do that. So as you heard, welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. And as you heard, I'm Teresa Faye Bustillos, Chief Program Director at Blue Shield of California Foundation, and your chair for the program. This program is, of course, supported by Blue Shield of California Foundation. It's entitled Ending Domestic Violence, Perspectives for Social Change. You know, people often ask us at Blue Shield of California Foundation, they're often surprised to learn that we support domestic violence. And they always ask us, you know, well, why does a health company or why does a health foundation insurer, you know, support domestic violence? And it's always a surprise when I get that question, because I always think to myself, you know, that really says a lot about how people view domestic violence, that they view it in this small silo that only a certain percentage or a certain type of organization or group would focus on. And so the response is always, you know, why not? Why aren't more people, why aren't more organizations understanding that intersection with domestic violence and supporting it? And that's always the answer that we give. You know, a lot of recent campaigns, scandals, and celebrity arrests have brought, you know, a lot of visibility to this issue of gender equality and domestic violence. Not the first time that visibility has been brought. And the Me Too campaign, a lot of incredible people have put their names on lists, have spoken out. But that's also not the first time that has happened. And for many Californians, you know, domestic violence is nothing new. And we kind of have to get beyond these moments in time where something happens and domestic violence is on the front page or in the New York Times. We really have to get to the place where we are today in this discussion, really understanding it. Because a staggering 40% of women in California report experiencing domestic violence in the past. One in four women and one in seven men will be abused by an intimate partner. The American Psychological Association says that close to 5 million women in the U.S. experience domestic violence every year. And for communities of color, almost 50% of Native American women have been raped, abused, or stalked by an intimate partner. And 30% of African American women have been subjected to domestic violence. And the statistics are similar for Latinas. And these numbers, you know, are the numbers that you hear when people think about or talk about domestic violence. But you know what it doesn't include? It doesn't include the children that witness it in the home. It doesn't include the relatives and the friends that hear about it or see it or feel helpless, or the children that wonder if they're next, or how these people handle with their loved ones or go back to the communities and the workplaces where survivors live, work, and raise families. It doesn't include that vast number. If we added those numbers in, you can only imagine in this room, if I ask people who have been exposed to domestic violence to stand, how few would remain sitting. It's a complex and formidable problem, and what we see on the news, you know, is often only part of the story. And if we're committed to truly ending it, and I do believe we can end this, then we must look at its root causes, and we must take a sober, honest appraisal about why it's happening. We know a lot, and you're going to hear from an incredible panel that's going to tell you about all the things we know about how to end domestic violence. And we have to ask ourselves, then why haven't we ended it yet? And that's what we have to do. And I know that we can. So I'm happy to tell you that we have just the right panelists to answer that question. And I hope that you're going to ask them those tough questions, because I know that you are committed to doing this. So we have Lisa James, who's the Director of Health at Futures Without Violence, an organization with offices in San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and Boston that has worked for over 30 years to end violence against women and children around the world. During her 20 years at the organization, Lisa has collaborated with healthcare providers and policymakers, as well as domestic violence experts in over 25 states to develop healthcare responses to domestic violence through training, policy reform, and public education. She's also worked internationally with leaders from non-governmental and healthcare organizations in Russia, Mexico, India, and China. We've also got Mark Philpart. He's a senior director at PolicyLink, a national research and action institute aimed at advancing racial and economic equity. He has over 10 years of experience in the boys and men of color field. And prior to joining PolicyLink, Mark worked in the president's office at PATH, a nonprofit global health organization. He holds a master's degree in both public affairs and public health. We have Sharon Turner, who's the director of client services at Stand for Families Free of Violence, a Bay Area organization that has been dedicated to helping victims of domestic violence for over 40 years. Sharon has worked at Stand for over 20 years and specializes in services that engage men and boys in preventing intimate partner violence, as well as community education, training, and teen dating violence. We have Jill Zuisa, who's the executive director of Women, Inc., which stands for Women Organized to Make Abuse Non-Existent. Isn't that what we all need? An organization that has operated since 1978 as a community-based agency serving survivors of domestic violence in San Francisco and the larger Bay Area. Jill has worked in the domestic violence field for over 20 years and has been a member of the Women, Inc. team for over 10 of those years. Jill is also a member of the Strong Field Project to End Domestic Violence. And our moderator today is Dr. Lee Kimberg, professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, director of the program in medical education for the urban underserved, and coordinator for intimate partner and family violence prevention at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. She is a nationally renowned expert on domestic violence. So please welcome all of our panelists as I turn the program over to Lee. Thank you.
Best in show.
Wonderful. Welcome to everyone here. I have learned that it's really important when discussing such a hard topic for us to stay grounded ourselves and take care of ourselves together. So before we start this conversation, let's just remember to take care of ourselves while we address this really challenging topic. As we've heard just now, domestic violence is so common that it's affected directly so many of us in this room and on the radio, directly in our families. All of us, this has affected us in our communities. So just please take a deep breath yourself and a long exhale, and then feel the weight of your body really connecting with the healing energy of the earth. And let's celebrate that although we're discussing this extremely painful topic, we're coming together, in fact, because we're having a dialogue about how to promote healthy relationships, how to promote healing, and how to promote social justice. So I think we can celebrate that. We're so fortunate to have this really experienced group of panelists. And so to start off, we were hoping that you could each describe the mission of your organization and the work that you do to prevent and mitigate the effects of domestic violence. Would you like to start, Lisa?
Sure. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here this evening. And my name is Lisa James, and I'm very pleased to be representing Futures Without Violence. We are a social justice and health organization that's been working to end violence against women and children for over 30 years. And we do that through a variety of different approaches. We have model programs, policy reform, social norms change campaigns, and we work very hard to train professionals in a variety of different sectors on how to identify and respond to survivors of violence and how to promote prevention. So lately here in California, we've been doing a couple projects I'll just mention because it might have a specific reference to the conversation that we'll be having this evening. But we've been working with healthcare providers in over 19 communities with the support of the Blue Shield of California Foundation, bringing healthcare providers and systems together with domestic violence programs again to promote prevention and seek out opportunities to promote prevention, identify survivors in need, and promote the health and safety of those patients. And then additionally, we've been working with the foundation to explore campaigns that will look at how do we confront gender-based violence and domestic violence, and particularly bridge the divide and create dialogue with those who may have different political views than our own, and thinking primarily looking at independent and maybe more moderately conservative and conservative communities. And what's their position around gender-based violence and ending domestic violence, and how can we get there together? So that's some work that we're doing here in California that's very current, and I'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you, Mark.
Good evening. My name is Mark Philpart. I'm a senior director at PolicyLink, and PolicyLink is a national research and action institute. We're headquartered right over in Oakland, California, and for the past 20 years, we've been advancing racial equity. For us, that work has looked like a focus on the most vulnerable people in our community and really advancing policy and systems changes that improve their outcomes. Specifically, we're focused on the nearly 100 million residents in this country that are in or near poverty. The work that I have led for about the past 10 years has focused on improving outcomes for boys and men of color. I manage an advocacy network called the Alliance for Boys and Men of Color, and that network has had tremendous success. Within the past 6 years, we've advocated for nearly 90 policies that have been signed into law here in California. The focus of that network has primarily been in spaces that haven't necessarily emphasized domestic violence. And so for the past couple of years, we've been really focused on deepening our understanding of the issue and trying to find ways to deepen our relationship with leaders in the domestic violence arena, with the generous support of the Blue Shield of California. Thankfully, we've evolved this work to a point where the leaders within our network are very excited about the opportunity to advance policy campaigns that get at this really complex intersection of keeping families safe and also advancing policy that doesn't necessarily deepen the disproportionate impact of the criminal justice system on communities of color. I'm really excited about this work. It includes Stand for Families Free of Violence, my partner to the left here, and Call to Men, a national organization very much targeting men and boys in the fight against domestic violence. Really excited to share that work with you today.
Thank you, Mark. Hello, my name is Sharon Turner. I am with Stand for Families Free of Violence, which is located in Contra Costa County. And we have been around for 40 years now. We started as a child abuse call center, actually, in a closet in Lafayette. And then as we began to unravel what are the root causes of child abuse, we found that many times the parents were passing on their pain to their child. Many times it was the mom that was passing on her pain. And it was partially because of that that we began to look at, let's kind of raise this and look at the root causes of what's happening in the home, what's happening with domestic violence. There began our 40-year journey. Today, we are both, we now call ourselves a family violence agency, where we're looking at the impact of intergenerational family violence as it relates from the many generations, as well as child abuse. In order to address this issue in Contra Costa, what's been important for us is to see ourselves working in three kind of major strategies. One has to do with saving lives. So for anyone that may be suffering from domestic violence, certainly we have a crisis line and the kind of immediate help that's needed to get that person to safety. We also talk about rebuilding families. Many times you will find that people don't want to leave, but they want the violence to stop. So how is it that you deal with both partners? As part of the rebuilding family strategies, one of the things that we do is we work with those who cause harm. That's a very important part of the healing. And then thirdly, we talk about changing the future. And this is actually where my work comes in. You could think of it as prevention at both the individual, prevention also at the social norms level, and prevention at the community and relational level. So a lot of our work has to do with that younger generation, starting young and doing an ounce of prevention there, as well as working with institutions like the faith institution, mm-hmm. places that people go to seek help. And so it's still a work in progress because trends are changing, right? Mm-hmm. And you need to go where trends change. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I'm Jill Zuiza. I work over at Woman Inc. We're real close by in the Soma. One of my coworkers is here representing. And we do a direct service as well. So we kind of orient that in crisis de-escalation. So we have a support line, a 24-hour line where folks can call. And we're very, very small. There's six of full-time folks at the organization. So we mindfully affiliate with organizations and networks that essentially we see as kind of helping kind of fill the gaps. We take an approach where we believe in healing through helping. And so we connect that with prevention. We use the stories, we use our own lived experience and the lived experience of our participants to really kind of change the community conversation around domestic violence and how the work is done. So we have past program participants who at this point are all Spanish speaking and have gone through our 40-hour training. It's what you need in order to be a domestic violence counselor in the state of California and some other states across the nation. But they're out doing the work and they're starting a support group in a couple of weeks. We'll just give a little plug for that. They're doing outreach. They're an amazing group of people that we've learned a tremendous amount from, and they're out spreading the word into their own communities. So we really honor that lived experience and that bravery, really, to share stories. And we also, in terms of building networks, we seek to kind of connect organizations. So we have a database that's about 70 organizations from across the state are members, and we share information as to which shelters are doing intake interviews for the day. So if you've done any DV work, you know the importance of having that little piece of information can be really pivotal for the person that you're connecting with. Mm-hmm. So that was another Blue Shield project to help us fund that big database that gets like 20,000 hits a year. So that's an example of how we build networks to really kind of connect the dots across the field and to the betterment of the survivor's experience. And we're here in the city, so come see us and give us a call. We'd be happy to host any of you to come stop by.
Thank you. So I was going to have us start out with talking about DV survivors. And Sharon, you pointed out that survivors really are the whole family, right? Mm-hmm. And many, many people connected to the experience of violence. But we're here today to discuss domestic violence with particular attention to under-resourced communities and marginalized communities, which means that we're really discussing the fact that people are not just experiencing domestic violence in their intimate relationships, but they're experiencing also many forms of structural violence, including racism, economic discrimination, anti-immigrant or anti-LGBTQ oppression, police violence, and more factors, right? So I was hoping that you could share some stories or some experiences that really get to your perspectives on what are the complex barriers that people are facing to have increased safety and empowerment, especially in the marginalized or under-resourced communities that you work in.
Should I start? Okay. I'll start with that. So I think for us, we speak with a lot of folks who are dealing with issues around immigration, specifically folks who might not have documentation to be here. And of course, as you can imagine, there's a litany of barriers and challenges that are attached to that. So I think there's a common misconception, perhaps, that our organizations are somehow connected to the criminal legal system directly. So it might not be safe for someone to call one of our organizations and just kind of get some support. And it can act as a barrier for resources in general. There's a lot of fear. Let's just be real about it. In a lot of ways, it's a legitimate fear. You know, there's been instances across the country where folks have been taken out of courthouses and put in ICE detention. It's not like it's this, you know, unfathomable fear that they have. So, you know, that doesn't just act as a barrier for them to access services necessarily. It also is a barrier for them to remove themselves from an unhealthy, unsafe situation. And if we're kind of toeing the line with messaging that isn't kind of being mindful of that very legitimate barrier, we're essentially marginalizing these communities even further. Mm-hmm. So we really have to be mindful in the way that we connect with folks and not make any assumptions about who they are and what their challenges are. I want to hear from other folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was also thinking that so when I started, I had a question about why is it that African-American women aren't accessing the shelter? And the over-reliance on the criminal justice system as it relates to African-American men as well as women is one still today a huge barrier. And there's also a barrier that the family, which might be the community that you live in, the neighborhood that you live in, that the secret needs to stay there. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, actually, if I look at part of what happens with domestic violence, the shame that's around that. And someone was asking, what's the will to break the shame? Mm-hmm. If we make it okay to talk about it, and not punish. There's a difference between, I think, punishment and accountability. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you're in a community where the punishment has happened so often, so long, it continues to promote, I'm not going to go to a shelter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep, and I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I would just add that, and also, I'm not going to seek. I'm not going to call the police, and I'm not going to go to the healthcare setting. And we have all seen what's happening now, and has been happening for many years. So, I really agree that we need to confront those barriers when we are actually providing services. One approach I would just share that's been effective is not being reliant on a disclosure-based support. So in whatever setting, in the work that I do, it's largely in healthcare settings, but providing universal education about the connection to violence, between violence and health, and then resources that are offered regardless of whether or not somebody discloses or not for all of the reasons that you've talked about. So that universal education approach, and then and secondly, when you're not looking outside of the systems that people are reluctant to seek services. So looking at more community-based, peer-based supports and intervention is a really critical piece as well.
I would also add that in many instances, from what we've seen and what we've studied, women are reluctant, women of color, low-income women are reluctant to call primarily, well, not primarily, but one of the contributing factors is because of being afraid that they may be deemed unfit parents, and they may jeopardize their parental status and custody of their children. And so that as a form of state violence, wresting a child from a mother, I think is something that we don't talk about enough, but definitely something that is a stigma associated with why people don't seek help.
Right. Yeah, we've seen that quite a bit in the healthcare setting where people don't necessarily want to disclose for that reason. Blue Shield actually commissioned a study about domestic violence in California, and they found that 91% of California residents surveyed agreed with this statement. For various reasons, victims of domestic violence might be just as afraid about getting the police involved in their personal domestic violence disputes as they are about facing the abuser again. So maybe you could delve a little bit more deeply into, you mentioned that, Sharon, this distinction between accountability and how can we balance accountability for the use of violence with a real fear of involving law enforcement or the criminal justice system in people's lives.
One of the things that we've had a what's called a batterer's intervention program, just the name itself, if you think about it, for since 1989. And in working with the men and the women that come to that program, it's a 52-week program, as you begin to, one of the things that I've continually hear about is that it's not just the systems, but it's their own self-esteem, their pain that they have experienced, their hurt that they have experienced, and so they pass, as I've said before, they pass it on. The other thing is that if they have witnessed domestic violence as a child, and especially if you, in terms of gender norms, and you figure out what it's, this is what a girl acts like, this is what a boy acts like, and so to be a man of the house, for example, it becomes sanctioned for you to is an expression of love, is what I hear in the young community, to kind of knock your woman around. It's not okay. So a lot of what we try to do is to say, this is about behavior. It's not about your human dignity, because you deserve to be treated with respect. And that the experiment that you're working with around how you're in relationship is not working. That takes a long time for people to really understand. And what we ask for people who come into the program is, can you take even a half of an ounce of responsibility for what you did? And that becomes the basis for the journey of healing for them. And sometimes they make it, sometimes they don't.
I think we have so much expertise on this panel about what you just raised in terms of gender norms and talking to people in respectful ways about the use of violence. So I wonder if others would like to comment more on work that they're doing in that way.
Sure. The science on gender norms says that most people are formulating their sense for gender norms in middle school. And when you think about all of the exposure type issues that contribute to violent behavior, those things are happening at that stage, if not younger, throughout a young person's formation of their identity. We then get to a point where they're an adult and we try to intervene and we try to undo all of that. And often it's too little too late. By the time people are presenting as, you know, violent and intimate relationships, we've missed so many other opportunities to be able to engage them. Mm-hmm. And so what we're trying to do and what we're exploring is, can we get to these young people earlier? We know that they've witnessed violence. Many of them have, both in their home, in their community. Mm-hmm. Shoot, for many, utilizing violence as a way of survival in the community. And so undoing it is actually working against a protective mechanism that they have just to survive in their neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So there's a real opportunity for us to be thinking more deeply about how to address these things from the very early stages. And I think if we're going to have a serious conversation in society about how to prevent intimate partner violence, we have to be thinking that young. We have to be thinking about young men in particular. And we have to be thinking about those young people who are the most vulnerable, the young people who we often want to exclude or not align ourselves with or be connected to, because those are the young people who are ultimately the most damaged and who suffer the most. And so I'm excited about the opportunity to embark on that challenge with many of you here, because I feel like that's the real work that we need to do.
Yeah. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And I would just add to that, I really agree with the points that have been made and the opportunities at a very young age. From a parenting perspective, to think of early intervention and prevention in the prenatal and perinatal, talking to new parents offers this incredible window of an opportunity to talk about violence prevention and possibly in the context of what somebody has gone through as a child themselves. So there is a huge opportunity in schools as an important opportunity to work with kids who've been exposed to trauma, all types of trauma. And we know that that has impact on their health and on their safety and on their risk for both perpetration and victimization moving forward. But we also know that there's a power of a supportive adult, and that supportive adult can really turn things around for children. So we're looking at those model programs that are working in schools and working in early Head Start and working in health settings to be that supportive adult to the best of their ability. And then lastly, I'll just mention a program also in schools and definitely implemented in a variety of different ways and settings across the country, which is looking at sports for social change. And at Futures Without Violence, we have a program called Coaching Boys Into Men, where coaches are talking to their athletes about respectful behavior to girls and women and what does that look like. In very brief conversations about what that might look like, we're seeing some real results. And it's one of the few sports-based interventions that the Centers for Disease Control has found effective. So the athletes are saying they're reporting that they're more willing to stand up to their peers and challenge them around respectful behavior towards women and girls, and that they themselves also report perpetrating less abusive behaviors. So I do think, to your point, that there is some that we know a lot about how to prevent violence. We need to learn a lot more, but we're on a pathway there as well that we can really build on.
I think what you said really resonated in terms of punishment versus accountability. And I think that when you're doing the work, that rings true when you say a lot of times it's not about wanting to end the relationship or leave. It's about wanting the relationship to be safe again or safe for the first time. And, you know, when you're in the position where you're supporting a survivor, you know, if we take that hardline stance of, well, no, this isn't right, you have to leave, we're kind of, it's flying in the face of what the survivor wants. And if we really want to be survivor-centered, we have to find some, it's complex, right? Mm-hmm. But we have to find some common ground there. So I think that is really connected to gender roles. And, you know, there's also the complexity that is gender. You know, it's not binary, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to make some space there. We have to do some probing and figure out sometimes what gender even means for the person that we're talking to. Mm-hmm. So again, complex, hard work.
But it feels like we're just beginning this one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, we began a model. I call it the single story model, and what's the opportunity right now is to open it up so that we can explore the complexity. Mm-hmm. I think it requires curiosity.
Yeah.
That really, we know some things, but maybe we have to throw those things away to begin to explore what's in front of us.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing about some different sectors of society as well. You're talking about Head Start programs, early parenting programs, schools, neighborhood groups as well. And I'm wondering if people can address partnerships for prevention and how this work can be done in partnership and how, in fact, as we're all finding, it needs to be done in partnership with multiple sectors in society to succeed in prevention. Or we could start with healthcare partnerships, because I know there's a lot of expertise here on partnering between healthcare and advocacy organizations, as well as some of the other ones you mentioned.
Well, I can start for that because I'm very passionate about those partnerships. And I really do think that there's an incredible opportunity to not only promote the health and safety of individuals, but to also decrease violence through health partnerships between the advocacy organizations and healthcare providers. And we've been doing that work for 20 plus years and finding that when you have those partnerships, you have an opportunity for both early identification and response, because people are coming to the healthcare setting for different reasons and not necessarily expecting to be talking about domestic violence. But when that door opens up, they may be in a different place than they would be if they'd been calling a domestic violence program or calling the police. And so you have an opportunity to do some early intervention there if somebody discloses. And again, to promote prevention by providing that universal education. So we've seen some incredibly valuable partnerships build there. And that also results in improved health. And one story I'll share with you all from the Domestic Violence Healthcare Partnership was after the partnership was formed between the domestic violence programs and really formalized between the health clinic, the domestic violence program was encouraging the client to seek healthcare and find a medical home. And as a result, she did, and she was able to get a whole host of screenings, and she was able to detect cancer very early on and get treatment. And she really credits the domestic violence program for encouraging her to build that partnership and to seek healthcare. And so it's a very much a bidirectional approach that improves both health and safety, and I think it's got a lot of promise for prevention and intervention.
I also think, Stan was one of the partners in working with Kaiser, one of the things that we discovered, yes, referral rates went up. People were much more likely to disclose domestic violence. The beauty of the partnership for us was learning how to walk in each other's cultures. Mm-hmm. And that it's, and learning from each other. So actually we're taking that model as we begin to look at some of the other sectors that we're working with. It just opens you up. You don't have to lose your expertise, but what happens is a rich exchange of expertises between each other.
Mm-hmm. Our founder, Angela Glover Blackwell, always says, nothing worth doing, nothing that can be done alone is worth doing. She would kill me for butchering that. But it really speaks to the true essence of who we are as an organization. We work as an intermediary in a number of different issue areas. None of them are areas where we have significant depth, the type of depth that my peers have, 40-year institution working in this space. So we have to engage people who are most proximate to these issues and have a deep level of understanding. We then take that work and try to develop policy solutions in partnership with them, and hopefully those organizations are in a position to where they're connected to people who are most impacted. Mm-hmm. Because it's their voices that really are the drivers of change, and that it's their experience where we can find solutions to some of the toughest problems. So we really try to do everything in partnership, and this arena is no different. And so we're in this space with the intention of engaging folks like Stand and others, so that we can engage their members and the people who they're serving to develop and advance solutions that really leverage the public sector and the ability of systems and institutions to really drive a prevention-oriented approach in this arena.
Mm-hmm. One of the audience members is asking about partnerships with schools. What are some of the challenges and the opportunities to partner with middle schools or high school populations to provide prevention programs? So I'd love to hear, you talked about, bridging different cultures, how some of our panelists have partnered with schools, and what are some of the challenges and successes in doing that?
Our work started with high schools back in 1985, and then in 1996 we shifted to middle schools because of some of the reasons you were saying, Mark. And the thing about behavior change is knowledge alone is not going to do it. So a lot of education. And I can remember one of the youth that we worked with, he was a seventh grade student, and we were using expressive arts as a way to really do some attitudinal shifts. And we were doing this impromptu kind of, put a skit up and impromptu act it out. And every time around conflict, they would fight or do this imaginary fight, the facilitator asks this young person, "So why is that? Because I've seen this three times now." And they said, "It's easier for us to fight than to find other solutions." Mm-hmm. And that, seventh grade, mm-hmm. easier to fight. So that's always stayed with me mm-hmm. as a reflection. Because in order to do long-term behavior change, I think we also need to look at the trauma that the young people are experiencing. They walk into school, and in some schools still today, there's the yelling or there's the disrespect. And until you work with the school staff in terms of their attitude toward youth, and, I understand standards, but really working with these young people don't deserve to be yelled at.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Work with the parents who are concerned about their grades. Young people don't deserve to be yelled at, or there's some nurturing that needs to go on. So it's working with the whole system. And then looking also at policy at the district level. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're finding, and actually getting to policy, there's a great thing that happens, but enacting the policy is a whole different thing. And I think that that's where the challenge is, mm-hmm. you know, so that you get some, what I would call advocates mm-hmm. that will want to change policy, but getting it through the whole school system is totally different.
Mm-hmm. Women Inc. is a part of a collaborative called Expect Respect San Francisco. Some of you might have heard about it. But essentially, it's a group of young people who go into high schools, and there's 3 days of presentations. And so Women Inc. will step in and do the third day. And we talk a lot about healthy relationships and a Bill of Rights. And, you know, in general, when we're presenting at schools or with young people, we try and take a kind of more positive spin on it in terms of this is how you deserve to be treated. Here's what a healthy relationship might look like. Here's some areas that you maybe consider red flags. But those partnerships, I agree, they can be hard because sometimes they don't want you to mention certain things. And, yes. you know, and then... I did a presentation a couple of years ago, and it was like, I just started laughing. It was like this horror story of like the teacher sleeping in the back, snoring, like to the point where I could hear him, and the kids were like jumping up and down, and you know, it was like a free period for them. It was crazy. So there's the different levels of engagement from the staff that you're trying really hard to partner with and make an impact with. So, it can be challenging on a lot of different levels, but it's really important work. And given the fact that we are small, and again, we mindfully affiliate throughout the community where we can, that particular collaboration really works well for us. And we serve on the steering committee so we can impact some of the curriculum. And it's been a really great experience.
There's also questions from the audience about if you could share a little bit more about how we're addressing domestic violence in the LGBTQ community as well.
So at Women Inc., we try to be very gender neutral with our messaging, and in part that is to really kind of be mindful of LGBTQ communities, in that, you know, when we use the kind of the single story narrative, and it's the woman who's the survivor or the victim and the man who's the abuser or perpetrator, right? We're marginalizing a huge number of folks. So we, as with every other kind of participant we deal with, we listen and kind of get what cues they're giving us. Who is it that we're talking to? What is their relationship? And, you know, there's a lot of struggles. We deal with folks a lot that can't get into shelter because they're trans, or they can't get into shelter because they're a gay man. And it can be really difficult. So I think it's really important in understanding those barriers exist and knowing where we might be able to connect to kind of really meet the needs of that survivor. We talk a lot about just kind of being real about our biases and as people and as advocates in this field, because, you know, like was mentioned, I've been doing this work for 20 years, you know, like I've worked with women on a personal, you know, level. When I'm thinking of a survivor, first thing that comes to mind to me is a cisgender, female, who's straight. Mm-hmm. So if I'm not willing to kind of step back from that and be mindful at least that that's my bias, I could really marginalize and kind of put out someone who's maybe queer or transgender. So I think it starts on an interpersonal level and an organizational commitment to serving LGBTQ folks and kind of figuring out, like, what can we do here? Where's our level of flexibility, and how can we create an open environment and be welcoming. And when we really kind of started focusing in on that conversation, in terms of our statistics, I think, gosh, Mary, I wish I could ask you, but I think by 1 year, it was like 30% increase in queer survivors mm-hmm. coming to the agency or calling the line. Mm-hmm. And that's just, it was like that whole build it, if you build it, they will come type of scenario. But it starts with as an individual and as an organization, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I would just add that in any of the partnerships that we work with, that's a core part of the work that we do, is exploring our own biases and then also providing resources in the health setting. It would be training resources for healthcare providers and patient resources for LGBT patients and trans patients. So we've got some new resources there, and we're in the process of doing a formal piloting of those and hopefully adapting and improving upon them and moving forward.
Mm-hmm. We've worked with our local LGBTQ community resource center for a number of years to both provide education both ways mm-hmm. and also to create the kind of structures and ways in which people can access the shelter.
I forgot to mention, if I can, really quickly, we're really fortunate to work with two local organizations here in the city, CUAV, Communities mm-hmm. United Against Violence, and ELLA para Trans Latinas. Two organizations, they're amazing. They work with LGBTQ folks who are experiencing state violence, CUAV, and domestic violence. And ELLA, they really have built community together for trans Latinas. So it's not to say that they can just be like, oh, you're a lesbian? Well, then you need to go talk to CUAV because we can't help you. But when we work together and we share our stories, each of us gets better at what we do. So we're in real good communication with both of those organizations.
So great. So that really helps us sort of understand how to build systems that make marginalized communities feel more included. So I'd like to bring us back to some other aspects of marginalization that we've discussed and just touched on briefly, but perhaps we could discuss a little bit more the relationship between racism and domestic violence and how marginalization and lack of resources, positive and helpful resources in communities, are affecting domestic violence.
Such a huge question.
Yes, it is a huge question. And just
where to start?
I think...
I would say first, you know, you have to look at the experience of people of color within this country and to, I think, center the conversation in that in order to be able to then talk about racism within the context of domestic violence. And we know that for at least people of color, there's a long history of discrimination which has resulted in many of the disproportionate experiences that people of color may have, whether it be the criminal justice system or what have you. And so I think the context of you know, how people of color are dealing with domestic violence and what their experiences within the domestic violence arena has to be seen through that prism. When I think about people of color's concentration and the fact that, you know, they are more likely to live in concentrated poverty. You know, I feel like that is a huge issue and contributor to the experience in domestic violence and whatever reticence they may have about engaging systems that are there to support or intervene. When I think about the disproportionality in the criminal justice system, obviously disproportionate contact with law enforcement, and it goes on and on. We talked about schools just a few minutes mm-hmm. ago and the achievement gap and the mm-hmm. fact that people of color who live in concentrated poverty are more likely to have failing schools in their communities mm-hmm. is part of this circular set of issues that really cause for disparaging circumstances. So, you know, the context is really important to me, and the historical elements of it mm-hmm. are critical to understanding then behaviors mm-hmm. That people demonstrate within the context of a situation. Mm-hmm. So I would start with that yeah. as a frame, and then quickly turn to one of my colleagues to fill in.
Thank you. Yeah, that frame is incredibly useful in terms of contextualizing what types of programs then we think are going to be helpful or we think are going to be useful. In terms of some model programs or some model policies that you've seen that you think are particularly successful or particularly promising, that would be useful to share as well. Perhaps giving some historical context to your work, too. There's a question about how long you've all worked in this field, which is many decades, and whether you see any progress, and what are the most promising solutions. So perhaps tying that together, if there are promising programs that you think are addressing this in a really contextualized fashion.
Those were several questions.
Well, there are some that I've started to explore that I mm-hmm. think hold real promise. Now, there's not a strong evidence base, I would mm-hmm. say, for many of these efforts that are beginning to do the types of things that I think would be worth scaling. Mm-hmm. But I mean, and you even mentioned some earlier, mm-hmm. Lisa, I think there's a lot of different programming happening, but it's happening in fits and starts. Mm-hmm. It's not happening in a way that is culturally centered or sensitive. Mm-hmm. And it's not happening in a way that has the full weight of public systems in support. And so what you see is like 1,000 flowers bloom, mm-hmm. and some are wilting and some mm-hmm. are thriving, but there's no floor that is really prevention oriented. That is getting at these issues in a strong and culturally responsive way. And so, I mean, I think that's part of the challenge when we are thinking about race within the context of this issue, is that the communities that need this most are often left behind. Mm-hmm. And the strategies that are available to leaders in this space are just inadequate to meet the need. And there's, I think some of that is changing. As Teresa mentioned earlier, we have a real problem with public will. But, you know, more and more, I think our legislators in California in particular are starting to stand up and say, you know, this isn't just a women's issue. This is an issue that is important for our families and communities. And you know, we're hearing that from the highest levels of leadership. And so it's really promising when things start to move in that direction.
I'd just add, this is also fits into the nascent programming, but the work that I mentioned, I think, a little bit earlier around changing minds and working to address child trauma should happen in the context of understanding racism and understanding the school-to-prison pipeline and recognizing who is getting kicked out of school and what is at the core of the behavioral problems in terms mm-hmm. of somebody's own exposure to trauma, be it domestic violence, be it racism or community violence or all of the above. So I am hopeful about that work. And again, positioning our opportunities for prevention there, be it through school counselors or teachers. But again, it's like you say, it's the blooming flowers. We need to scale it up and really study its impact moving forward. But I am hopeful for that work, and I am hopeful and inspired by what I've seen recently as sort of that aha moment of the connection of understanding the impact of child trauma that it has on violence across the life course and our opportunity to prevent it moving forward.
So we'll touch a little bit more on root causes, because there are a couple of questions here about root causes. And you just mentioned child trauma, and we've mentioned being exposed to domestic violence as a child. But if there are other root causes that you would like to suggest, or just elaborate on that exposure and how that affects the future development of domestic violence.
Well, I think if you're going to talk about root causes, I think it's just a lack of power, because folks who use harm and abuse in their relationships are seeking power and control. So why are they why is it that the only way they know how to go about that is to use abuse? Or why is that in their tool shed as a potential way of getting it? So there are a lot of people in our country who systems and structures were set up to take away their power. It was done with intention, by design. And we're talking about people of color. I think we're specifically, and you know, the disproportionate number of people of color in prisons. It's like, systematically taking power away perhaps I'm oversimplifying, and it's a conceptual framework, but I just think it's key. People feel disempowered for a lot of reasons, but not all of us feel disempowered because a system was set up to work against us, not for us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If I could just build briefly on that. I
Please
mean,
do.
When I think about men of color, and I think about our experience in this country, I mean, you know, the archetype that many people are operating from is a white cisgendered male, and the opportunity for people, men of color, to be able to achieve that status and the power and privilege that goes along with that is limited by these structural challenges that we have, right, and the persistence of racism. And so, you know, what does that mean, right, if you are supposed to be the breadwinner in your home and you can't find a job, you have no job networks, you live in a community that is, you know, disproportionately devastated by unemployment. What does that do to how you perceive yourself, right? And we all know the old adage, hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm. You lash out to those closest to you. And not to make an excuse, but to describe, I think, some of the factors that impinge on people of color in particular as we're thinking about this issue of domestic violence in families and communities. It really is a difficult thing to unravel and address.
Mm-hmm. And just to add within that context and framework, of course, is the issue of gender inequity and where, how can we look at the programs that are looking at redefining masculinity in a way that addresses the realities, particularly of structural violence, but also then get at gender inequity and the pressures on both boys and girls to conform to the gender norms, and how does that lead to the ongoing violence moving forward? So in thinking about root causes, that would be something I would want to be sure to make core to our work, obviously. And I do think that there's an opportunity there to confront those norms, and that's happening now. There's the programs like the mask you live in, right, being shown throughout the schools and being discussed. And it's just an opportunity to really relook at those norms and try to redefine them and reclaim them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I feel like there's so much more to discuss, but unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for just a last question. And who have showed up or tuned in to this episode of the Commonwealth Club because they care about ending DV. And there are quite a few questions here about how people can address domestic violence themselves. Either there are a couple questions either in the context of their own families or in doing getting more involved in this. So if you could maybe each briefly share a little bit of advice if people are not yet directly involved in work in domestic violence work or engaging in taking some action to end domestic violence, how could they engage either on a personal level with their family or community or on a programmatic level?
You know, as you were speaking, I was what was coming up for me is someone that I met years ago who talked about this issue of accountability. This was actually a Christian minister, and he was being awarded for a program that's called Men of Merit, men who demonstrate that strength does not equal violence. And it's a local, it's something that happens annually in Contra Costa. But this, his name was Jerome, and what he talked about is that often his peers would come to him and, you know, really try to say, I'm really tired of this woman or whatever. And he said, please remember to hold accountability in love. And that has stuck with me. What does that look like? But it's not further, again, punishment and or you're wrong, but to hold that person in high regard and to say, that wasn't right, bro.
So engaging in that dialogue with your community, with your friends, your family. Love and respect, but accountability. Other comments?
I would just add, I feel like the field is really in a reflective moment that is quite powerful. There's an opportunity, I think, within that for everyone to step back and take a look at what they have either contributed or what they can do. And I think there's power within that because you can start to have conversation, you can start to have dialogue, and you can do it in a way that is safe and not necessarily triggering to move people forward. And I think that's really what's needed. I think we have to be thinking about you know, the numbers say that, you know, many of us in this room have either been exposed to or have contributed to or have been, you know, involved in some way, some sort of domestic violence. And it feels to me like there's an opportunity there, and we should be thinking about, you know, our positional power. what we can do. If you're a systems leader, there's an opportunity there for you to be thinking boldly about how you might be able to raise these issues within your respective agency. If you're a parent, there's a tremendous opportunity for you to break down gender norms and to put forth a more healthier form of being. I also think there's an opportunity for people to step into being feminists. I really do believe that there's an opportunity for more people to align themselves with being feminists. I consider myself a feminist. And I think that's a really powerful stance in this day and age when we're being exposed to so much interpersonal violence. So I'll stop there.
I think it's really important to remember how the movement started. You know, it wasn't about brick and mortar organizations. It was women from the second wave of feminism coming together and supporting each other in your kitchen, you know, listening, not blaming, you know, being there for each other. You don't need to be an expert. You don't need to have done the work for 20 years, a year or a day to be of support to someone who's like, hey, this is going on in my home and I don't know what to do about it. You know, I think it's helpful just to kind of leave your agenda at the door and listen. You know, generally speaking, people will tell you what they want of you, and it might not be any follow-up whatsoever, but listening with an open heart and actively listening to the needs and just not thinking we can't solve it, right? We can't solve it for a person. We can't step into their shoes and live their life the way that we think would be the best for them, right? But if you plant a seed and kind of they remember that they had this experience with you where they felt validated and heard and seen. Power, what a gift. Like how few of us can really like say that, you know, there's a lot of people in the room probably who can say like, oh yeah, and that wasn't my experience if they've reached out. And most of the time survivors reach out to friends and family before they ever call one of us. So if we can kind of get that response down, I mean, we're going to be doing pretty good, I think.
That's right.
And I would just add to that, absolutely listen and believe and be a role model. Live by the violence-free lifestyle. Advocate for policies that will support both domestic violence programs and prevention across the board and be a vocal advocate for that. And then believe that violence is preventable. Look into the research and see it is preventable and we can get there. So be part of the believers.
On that inspiring note, we are going to close and thank our panelists, Lisa James, Director of Health at Futures Without Violence, and Mark Philpart, Senior Director at PolicyLink, Sharon Turner, Director of Client Services at Stand for Families Free of Violence, and Jill Zawisa, Executive Director of Woman Inc., Women Organized to Make Abuse Non-Existent. This program has been generously supported by the Blue Shield of California Foundation, and we thank you, our audience, here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Dr. Lee Kimberg, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned. Good job to you.